I think it's time for us to get started. If you haven't noticed from the screen, Ask the Experts is immediately after this session. If you didn't get a chance to get a drink at the happy hour that just happened before this one, is your chance to have a drink there and get all your questions answered. If you did have a drink, you can get a second round at the Ask the Experts, so it'll be fun for everyone. Also, the VMM team has been handing out a survey that I see some of you are filling out. Please fill it out. They're using this feedback to kind of drive some of the features that they prioritize in the next release. So it's your chance to actually, get your voice into what goes into the product. When you're finished, just leave it on your chair or hand it to the person at the door. All right, with that, we can get started. My name is Greg Cosenza. I'm a program manager on the data center networking and platform team. I'm joined here today with Sudhir Avadi. He is a group engineering manager on the data center networking and platform team as well. He's responsible for the quality of the product and did a lot of great work on CPS, and his team did. And so we're here to talk about networking in CPS. We're going to do a deep dive to kind of try and answer all those questions you might have about how networking is designed in CPS and what goes on deep on the inside of it. The things that you may not necessarily need to know as an user and operator of CPS, but still want to know, what's going on behind the scenes. I'd also like to introduce you to CPS Guy. He is smiling and happy because he just got his CPS rack up and running after it arrived a few days ago. He's also very happy because he didn't have to create a logical switch in VMM or do any of the system center stuff that that normally frustrates him. This is Do-It-Yourself Guy. He orders all the hardware himself and installs the software himself. Here he is just getting started with everything that he has to do to get his system up and running. He just finished several hours of working with VMM and other system center products and got part of the way there. At some point, he'll call support, try to get help to get things working the way they are supposed to be. Of course, support, finding the right person is often a challenge. But eventually, he'll get there. And I think a lot of you, how many of you identify with Do-It-Yourself Guy today and the things you have to go through to get your environments up and running? Yeah, I think it's quite a few of you. And so how many of you would like to be CPS Guy and think that, in the future, you want things just work when they arrive? All right, good. Well, regardless of who you want to be, whether you want to stay as Do-It-Yourself Guy or CPS Guy, this session, I think, will help all of you because, we're going to tell you the things that went into CPS. If you're going to be a CPS user, you'll use that to install and get the system up and running. But if you're going to continue to do it yourself, you can use these same principles in your own systems, your own build, to get them up and running, with less effort. So the basic agenda, I'm going to start at a pretty high level, probably a 200 level, talk about some of the principles that went into CPS, how we designed it, some of the things that you would need to know as a user of CPS, somebody that just ordered it, you're going to set it up in your data center. And then I'm going to start to drill down into the deep dive of, what goes on inside the boxes. And then I'm going to hand it off to Sudhir, who's going to talk about, performance and reliability and the things that we did, to make sure it would work really well for you. So let's start with the design principles. About 2 years ago, we started, on this project, and we were basically given the goal of building, what it says up top, this Azure consistent cloud in a box. What does that really consist of? Obviously, Azure consistent means we have to look at Azure and what it, it's made from and how it's architected, how it's exposed to the user so that we can build it as Azure consistent. At the same time, because it's consistent and it's not Azure itself, we can use a lot of the other tools that we have, in our software components to actually build this and put it together. If you've gone to any of our networking sessions over the last couple of years, you've probably seen this slide where we talk about, what we have in Windows Server and Cloud OS and how you can basically build as a service provider, a cloud with network virtualization with the System Center components and with Windows Azure Pack, you can expose that cloud to your users, in much the same way as Azure does in the top left corner. If you're building a private cloud, you're acting as essentially a hoster for your own enterprise, you build a very similar environment. So we've been talking about this Azure consistency for a while, so it's only natural that Cloud OS is what actually powers CPS for its Azure consistent experience. And so we built off of the SDN capabilities that are in Cloud OS, then I'll be talking about how we expose those. So let's get into some specifics on, you know, what are the influences and the design principles that we went through. You know, the first thing that, you know, was identified was that the scale of what we're dealing with would start from one rack and scale up to potentially four racks in what we call a stamp. So a stamp can come in any one of these ranges of one to four racks. Now, in looking at how Azure builds their networks and how they build their equivalently sized components, they realize that a layer two network doesn't really span well across, you know, more than one rack. Once you start to span across, you run into issues that require complex protocols like spanning tree, potentially Trill, things like that. And so what they did is they built what's called a flat layer three network. This flat layer three network basically routes from point to point. So from the Tor switch to the aggregate switch, that's a route. You have a point to point slash 31 subnet there that routes between them. And then they wired up their switches in a way where every switch, whether it's the top of rack switch that connects up to the aggregate switch, is connected to every switch in the layer up above that. This is called a class topology. And it's been used in the telecom industry for a while. But basically, it says that, you know, you do have this interconnecting set of connections that as you add more switches and more racks, you get a linear increase in your bandwidth, right? Because you're adding a connection not just from your old aggregates into the new TORs, you're also adding connections from your old TORs into your new aggregates. So with each rack you add, you get a linear increase in bandwidth going across. So your original workloads aren't impacted by the additional racks you add. The other one of the other good principles about this this topology is that it's always just one hop to go to any of the other racks in this stamp. You know, if you're going from rack one, it's one hop up and back down to rack two. And then also, because you have so many different possible paths, using ECMP, equal cost multipathing, you can actually use any of those paths. So you actually have a lot of redundancy in this type of network as well, because you can choose any one of those links to go up and back down. The switch will do that for you. And if one switch goes away, if it goes down for whatever reason, then BGP, which is used heavily in the stamp, will update the routes between all these different devices and basically send the traffic around the link or the device that's no longer functioning. So that gives us great reliability, great bandwidth, great performance in the physical network. But when you do things this way, it does present some challenges. When you're doing these routing and you don't extend layer two from rack to rack, essentially every rack gets its own subnet, right? And we're defining a very static configuration for your environment. That makes it difficult to make, you know, Azure consistent virtual networks. We have every tenant has their own isolated network, because you don't want to go into this physical configuration and, you know, recreate it for every one of them. Fortunately, we have a solution, which is called virtual networking. So this has been available in Windows Server 2012 R2. System Center supports it. And basically what it does is it lets you create an overlay on top of your physical network that gives you a virtual network that can span all of these different subnets with a single, you know, tenant-defined subnet. The other advantage, of course, is since this subnet does span all your racks, you can now move the VMs around from rack to rack and really pack in your tenants. So if rack one is starting to get too full, you can spread them out and move those tenant VMs across to another rack. Of course, it also gives you the tenant isolation. You know, for these tenant VMs, as they get created, they will stay isolated from each other. And of course, VMM has all of this built in. So this capability is already there. And so we simply configured it. We configure all the components that you need for this in advance before the racks arrive at your site. And it's all up and running. You don't have to figure out how to do it yourself. Another key principle of, you know, a cloud environment is the ability to take whatever application it is that you're deploying. And how many of you saw this in the keynote where Jeff Woolsey, using the Azure Pack, took the slider and slid across to increase the number of instances he had in his cloud? You know, being able to scale out like that should be as easy as dragging a bar, you know, a slider across, and it is with the Azure Pack. But of course, when you create these new instances as you scale out, each one gets its own IP address, and so you need a way to have a single point that you talk to, which is your virtual IP, that then spreads out that load across, you know, all of those instances as you scale them out. And then if you scale them back in, those addresses need to get removed. So we manage all that through a load balancer. I'll talk a lot about that in a little bit, about how we configure that and use it. Next thing for Azure consistency, of course, is the UI has to be very consistent. Have any of you never seen the Azure pack before? Okay, you've all seen it before, and I'm guessing the first time you saw it, you probably thought you were looking at the Azure portal itself. Well, that's somewhat intentional, because we do want to give the users of the Azure pack the same experience. In the case of networking in particular, we have the same virtual networking panel that Azure has in the Azure pack, and it gives you the same basic set of capabilities. It's Azure consistent. It's not exactly Azure, but it's very close. There are a few things, though, that when you compare Azure with what we have in CPS that don't actually carry over for a number of good reasons. First is their approach to resiliency. When you have the scale of Azure, you're that big, you can afford to lose a fairly large chunk of hardware due to any one failure, because you just spin up those workloads on other capacity you have in many of your other hundreds or thousands of racks. For CPS, when you're talking about 1 to 4 racks, that doesn't work, right? You can't lose one entire rack because a switch goes down. So we took a slightly different approach to resiliency and made sure that every component in the network can survive the failure of one of each device type, so that if something does fail, your tenant workloads will not be impacted. The other thing that we didn't take from Azure was their management infrastructure. They've really embraced this DevOps role where their developers are the ones that do the management of their infrastructure. That doesn't really translate well into a product that we sell to all of you. And we know that all of you are familiar with System Center and VMM and how it works and all the different components of System Center. So we use that as the foundation of CPS. Now, we did add a whole lot of runbooks and management packs for Operations Manager so that take advantage of the fact that we know exactly what this topology looks like. So let's take a look at what do you need to know as a customer of CPS to be able to hook it up to your environment and some of the things that you need to supply as part of getting it set up and running in your environment. Now, if you think of this CPS stamp as an appliance, there are a few places where you actually connect it into your own data center. Starting from the top, you connect the aggregate switches, which are really the highest level of switch in CPS, up to your own border devices. Through a set of SFP plus connections. So a minimum of 2 per ag device going up to each of the one to each of the your border devices. And there are enough ports that you could actually do 4 connections up. If you do the math, then that comes out to 160 gigabits of connectivity, if I did the math right. Spencer in the back can correct me if I did wrong. So that gives you your off-stamp north-south connectivity. And again, this also increases linearly as you scale out from 1, 2, 3 to 4 racks. You get a linear increase in your bandwidth here as well. So it's the same class topology extending up to where we talk to the border of your data center. The other connection that we require into your data center is this 1 gigabit Ethernet for the serial to Ethernet port translator. This gives us essentially, or you essentially, a way to get into the physical switches if they aren't responding to anything else. You can connect to their serial ports through this Ethernet connection. But it is something you need to be aware of because a lot of data centers these days don't have 1 gigabit Ethernet available by default anymore. So it's important to be aware of that if you set it up for the first time. And then the other piece, with this hardware load balancer that's included, in the CPS stamp, it doesn't actually sit in the CPS racks. It sits adjacent to CPS. But it's connected directly into CPS, into its internal switches. So it's essentially logically part of CPS, the CPS appliance, if you will, even though it sits outside of it. You don't connect the load balancer to your own network directly. It goes entirely through those border connections up top that you've established. We'll fully configure the load balancer. It's dedicated to CPS for its purpose so that it can be fully configured and used by CPS. And I will talk more about that in later slides. As you work your way up, now that you've got the physical connections established, there is some information you need in order to be able to essentially actually send traffic over these wires. First is that when you connect up to your border, you have to configure your border into a port channel with an IP interface because this layer 3 routing extends up to your border. We use BGP internally to propagate the routes around. If something changes, we propagate it. So we strongly recommend that you peer those border switches with our stamp internally. Now, you don't have to extend the peering beyond that. If you don't use BGP in your own data center, you can bridge it to OSPF or potentially even use static routes at that point. But it is strongly recommended that you peer with BGP. And of course, ECMP is also used there. In the same way that we go from, you know, our top of rack switches up to the aggregate, it's a very similar configuration going up to your border. And so that's really it for connectivity, all you need to connect. Now, it doesn't matter if your border device is some other vendor. You're a shop that uses any other networking vendor. These protocols are very standard, very simple, very common, regardless of what your vendor is. So it's very easy to connect, you know, this Dell Force 10 networking equipment to whatever your equipment is. So as we move up the stack, you know, the next thing you need to think about is IP addressing. You know, all of these layer 3 connections require a lot of different subnets. And even when you get down into the rack, you need subnets, you know, to connect your VMs to and to route the traffic in between each of these racks. So in order to do this, we ask for what we consider supernets. So these are the large subnets that we'll carve up internally to smaller subnets. Now, you supply us with these large supernets, and you set up the routing to go in these supernets into the stamp, and then we take care of, once it's in the stamp, where they get routed from there on. The basic things that we ask for, the first one is called, we call it port private. This essentially represents your management network, your back end, your management network that goes on and off the stamp, so you can reach the VMM console or the other console machines if you need to from off the stamp. We use it for the infrastructure VMs, the Hyper-V hosts, a variety of the other components in the stamp. We then ask for what's called stamp private. And this is for the subnets that never actually leave the CPS stamp. This is used for east-west traffic. It's used for network virtualization because these provider addresses for network virtualization never leave the stamp. It's used for the load balancer back-end networks, again, because these stay in the stamp. They never go outside of it. And so you could actually use the same stamp private network if you have multiple CPS stamps. You can use the same subnet actually over and over again if you really wanted to, if you have a limit on how many subnets you have available. The next one we ask for is what we call external. This is typically your internet-facing subnet. So if you do have tenant workloads that are facing the internet, this could be an internet-routable subnet. You could also define it as put it behind a NAT or whatever other sort of external type of translation you want to do. But it is for your workloads to be able to get on and off of the stamp bidirectionally. And then the last one is the forwarding CA address space. So we have a number of these optional forwarding gateways, or forwarding networks that we call them, where they're commonly used for, you know, larger shared networks, things like a DMZ, where you have a lot of VMs that connect to it, and they all have a certain isolation requirement. So we provide a few of these forwarding gateway subnets that you can use for these larger shared networks. You can also use it for if you have infrastructure that you want to put in here and route to your infrastructure network as additional pieces, you can put them in one of these forwarding CA subnets. So once we ask for those, this will show you a little bit of what goes on behind the scenes. We use this tool that we call our CPS IP address calculator to actually break these subnets down into pieces. So this is something we do before we ship the rack to you. We run this new CPS address space commandlet. We pass in these subnets, including the V6 subnets as well, because we do support V6 in the stamp. And this tool basically is going to run, and it's going to go and break them all up into the individual smaller subnets that we need in the stamp. So you can see we use a bunch for the loopbacks. Those are the /32 subnets. We have a lot of point-to-point subnets. These are the /31s for going in between each of the different switches. We have some for the front end of the forwarding gateways. Those are also similar to the point-to-point infrastructure for the hosts, VMs, and then all of the back-end ones as well. So this tool breaks it up, and then we'll even actually assign IP addresses to certain devices from these subnets as well. This tool will go and do all of that. We then feed all of this data into our configuration script to go and do the deployments of the software, configure the hardware, the VMCs, and all of the things that need to happen before we actually ship the rack to you. So this is one of the tools that we built to actually make our deployments easier. And one of the things that all of you typically have to do in your own deployments, we'll do that for you. A few other things you'll want to know. DNS, we have DNS in the stamp as part of AD for the infrastructure purposes. You'll want to be able to have a forwarder so that you can look up external addresses that you need to reach. Your workload VMs will need to use an off-stamp DNS. We don't provide one there for you in the stamp. You would typically connect to one that you already have as part of your infrastructure. AD, you know, again, we have a stamp AD. One of the goals of the stamp is to make it completely self-sufficient. So we actually don't depend on anything outside, but you may actually want to connect it to your own infrastructure AD. And then we do need an NTP server for the switches. They need to have, you know, their time set correctly, and they have to get it from somewhere. So we need an NTP server that we connect to. Once that's all done, you know, and you get the stamp, then it's basically ready to use. And so this gives you a little bit of idea of what you can do with the stamp as soon as it arrives. You know, notice I'm not going into System Center right now. I'm actually going straight into the Azure Pack. You don't need to go into System Center and do any of the configuration there. It comes already configured. So what we're doing here is logging into the Azure Pack. And we're going to go into the virtual networking panel and connect to one of the virtual networks that we've created. So you can see here, this is for Northwest Insurance. We have a virtual network here that has, it's configured for NAT. It's got a bunch of VMs connected to it already. We've defined, the customer has defined the subnet they want, in this case 192.168.1. They've enabled NAT. They have a gateway on it, so they are routing. We have BGP available if you are using a site-to-site tunnel or as a tenant and you want to connect to your own BGP or on-prem. You can do that. And then in this case, there is a site-to-site tunnel connected, and it's established. Now we're going to go into the actual VM and show that that site-to-site tunnel is working. So here we're connecting to a VM through the console directly. So it's going to connect through the robot desktop. And then we'll do a few things to show you that you know, this VM is on a separate subnet from what it's connecting to. So now we're in the VM. And so here you can see we're actually pinging something off the stamp. This is going through the site-to-site tunnel. And then you can see that its IP address is a little bit different. Obviously a different subnet from what it just pinged. We're going to do a trace route to show you that, you know, the hops that we do going from the VM up into the virtual network. So the first hop will be the distributed router of Hyper-V network virtualization. The second hop will be the software gateway that basically does the translates you from your virtual network onto your physical network and creates your site-to-site tunnel. The second hop is a switch that isn't responding to the ping. And then the final hop will be your destination, which is through the site-to-site tunnel after the at a remote site. Final thing we're going to do here is we're going to actually connect to, you know, just to show you that it is a live working connection, we're going to connect to a web server at the other side of the site-to-site tunnel and show you that, there it is, it works. So this is ready to go. As soon as you get CPS and it's up and running, you know, this is, you can start doing this right away. There's no other configuration you need to do. So now let's see what is actually configured on the stamp. So what did we do before we gave it to you to get it actually up and running in this way that you can use it when it arrives? Now, if you've seen, gone to some of the other CPS sessions, you've seen how we break it, each rack down into a network scale unit, compute scale unit, and a storage scale unit. Within the compute scale unit of particular interest to us is this edge cluster, which I'll be talking about, which is what's used to translate from the virtual network into the physical network. We have to set aside a couple of nodes essentially to act as a router and to do the translation between virtual and physical networks. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to drill down into this network scale unit, show you what it contains. At the top of the network scale unit, each rack contains what we call the aggregate switch is what connects you to the outside world and then connects down to all of the other top of rack switches. The first top of rack switch is the BMC switch. This is what connects to each the BMCs in each of the devices. It also connects to the management ports of all the other network devices in the rack. It's just a 1 gig switch, and it's the one key point that isn't actually HA, that isn't N plus 1, because it's not actually in the data path. It's really only used to power on and off the machines. So if it goes down, it's not going to affect the actual tenant workloads in there. The next set of switches are what we call the tenant switches. These are the switches that are connected to the virtual switch that all the VM traffic goes over. Now, since the virtual switch is connected to these through two adapters that are teamed, that LBFO team needs to have a same layer 2 connection going to each of those switches. And so in order to make these switches work together and enable LACP on these connections, we configure them in a way using what's called MC-LAG. It stands for multi-chassis link aggregation. It basically makes these two switches act as one switch. Each one gets a permanent address, and then there's a floating address that is the router that the VMs actually see. On the other side, we also have what we call the data center switches. These are going into the adapters that provide RDMA for the storage system to use. And so if we actually drill down into the host to actually show you what that looks like, you can see how the tenant switches, which are used by the VMs, and these are the ones that actually receive the NVGRE encapsulated traffic, they go into those two Mellanox cards, which are then teamed into the virtual switch, and then the VMs use that traffic. Those are each 10 gigabit NICs, so with the team, you get an aggregate of 20 gigabits per second out of that. For storage and all of the other host functions, there are two Chelsio cards that support RDMA, and all host functions essentially go over that. So your host management, whether it's the VMM agent, WMI, all of your SMB traffic, your live migration traffic, which is also accelerated with RDMA, and even your cluster heartbeat, all go over that Chelsio, those Chelsio adapters. Those are the only ones that the host parent partition actually sees. So if you look at VMM, which is actually running in a VM, in order for it to talk to the Hyper-V host, it actually goes through the virtual switch, the team, the Mellanox adapters, into the tenant switch, up to the aggregate, back down to the data center switch, and then into the host. So it all happens very fast, but that is the path that it generally goes through. Storage nodes are configured very similarly from the physical network side. We actually have the same Mellanox adapters connected in there. We don't use them for storage because there's no virtual switch. There are no VMs running on the storage nodes, so they don't actually get used, but they're still there for consistency of the wiring. The Chelsio cards are the ones that do, you know, all the work on the storage nodes. So now if we look at the physical connectivity in the rack and how everything is wired together, of course, all of your compute nodes, management nodes, storage nodes, they're all connected to the BMC so that we can reboot and deploy the OS to them originally. They're also connected to the data center switches, with each one with two connections, and the tenant switch with two connections. Those are all 10 gigabit SFP plus connections. The team's hanging off of those tenant switch connections. And then each one of these switches now is connected up to the aggregate in its own rack. And then each one has a connection to each aggregate in every other rack. Now, what you see here is actually, though, what a one-rack configuration looks like. A one-rack configuration, which normally a rack would only have one aggregate switch, you actually get a second aggregate switch that will sit outside of that one rack because we actually have the racks completely full. And in a one rack, you have to put that aggregate switch outside of that rack. But it's still needed, though, for the redundancy so that you still have multiple paths to go up and outside of your switch. Then the class topology extends up into the customer core network from there. The connections from your data center and tenant switch up to your aggregate, each one of those lines represents 40 gigabits of connectivity going up. The BMC switch only has one gigabit connection because there's very little traffic that actually goes over it. When you add your second rack in, or third and fourth, they actually have very similar connectivity, you know, from the hosts up. Of course, you don't have a management cluster in there. They connect to their own aggregate switch, but then they also connect over to across to the other aggregate switches in your stamp. These also use 40 gigabit connections going up into those aggregate switches. So when you do have these multiple connections, you now have multiple paths to go up. Quick question. So it's 40 gig from the data center and tenant switch up to the aggregate. From aggregate to core, it's 10. So, yeah, so you can have 2 to 4 connections for each of those aggregate switches up to each up to your core devices. So minimum of one connection to each core device, or you can we have enough ports that you can do 2 up. So we do a port channel where the links get combined, and so they can act as, and then ECMP going to the different devices, so they'll act together. This next demo, we'll see ECMP actually in action going from some VMs on the management cluster up through the aggregate switch and then back down to a Hyper-V host. So what you see here initially is two console VMs. I'm using remote PowerShell to connect into them. You can see console 3 and console 4 are the two connections that I'm using here. First thing we're going to look at are the IP address configurations on each of these console VMs. You can see they're both on the same subnet, different addresses, and they're both pointing at the same .1 gateway. So, these are both, they're in the same rack, they're all pointing at the .1 of their tenant switch because these are in VMs. So what I'm going to do now is a trace route from each of these to the same Hyper-V host, and look at the path that the traffic actually takes. So on the first hop, the first thing you're going to notice is that the response actually didn't come from .1. It actually came from 2 and 3 for each of them. This is because of the MC lag configuration in those top-of-rack switches. It responds with the real address of the device, not the floating .1 address, because that floating .1 address is actually a VIP that's used. The next thing you'll notice is that as you go up from there above, now you're having a point-to-point link. So each one is going to a different IP address. Now, you can't tell yet from that second hop, that 142 and 108, that they're going to, whether or not they're going to separate or the same device. Because remember, each link that goes into a single device has its own source and destination IP on it. But you can tell, though, from the data center switch, which is the third one, as it goes back down from the aggregate to the data center switch, if it was the same aggregate switch, then it would use the same link and the same IPs to go down to the data center switch. But here in this case, it's actually going to two different IPs, so that tells me that I'm going from two different aggregate switches down to the same data center. And then the same data center is then going down directly to the Chelsea, one of the Chelsea adapters that's in the Hyper-V host. So you can see that the traffic went up actually to two different TORs, to two different aggregate switches, down to the same data center switch, and then into the Hyper-V host. All right, so now that we've talked enough about the physical connectivity, let's look at the logical networks that we have. Logical networks, if you've used VMM, you're familiar with defining logical networks at this point. But they're basically how we group all these subnets together across all the racks, to give them essentially named uses. The first one is the infrastructure network. This is what all of your hosts are located in the infrastructure network, and all of the subnets for the hosts. All of your management VMs are in this infrastructure network. All of your live migration traffic goes over this infrastructure network. It's really the logical representation of all these different subnets. Since they're all can talk to each other equally, all get put together under this one name. We have a logical network for the BMC management network, because there's a very certain set of isolation that the BMC gets that's separate from everything else. So all the host BMCs go in there, and we also connect the deployment server to that network as well. Going down to the bottom left, we have the network virtualization logical network. This is where all the provider addresses for the physical addresses for network virtualization, they all come out of this subnet down here in the corner. The switch management network, this is used for the actual management ports of the switches. It has its own set of security requirements and isolation, so it's carved out separately even from the BMC network. And then the services and load balancer networks, they're both very similar networks. They're both backends of the load balancer. Except we carved out the services logical network for the service provider-owned VMs, such as if you're using the Azure websites. These are VMs that are owned by the service provider, but they contain tenant code or tenant workloads that are running on them. And so they have a separate isolation requirement to keep them separate from the rest of the infrastructure. So we carve these out as a separate network. Load balancer network is the back end for the load balancer for tenant workloads. So if a tenant wants to create a VM, that's behind the load balancer, it'll get connected to that. This is where all the virtual IPs or the dynamic IPs for the load balancer go. External, I mentioned this one earlier. It's really for the externally facing addresses, whether it's internet routable or not. Things like the site-to-site endpoint comes from this subnet. The front end for the load balancer, all the virtual IPs on the load balancer, or most of them, come from this network, or the externally accessible ones. And tenant workloads can even connect to this network directly. If you want to give them a direct connection off stamp, you can connect them to this external network. Final one in the corner is for the forwarding gateways. These forwarding gateways act basically like routers, and so they actually need their own point-to-point connections from the software routing up into the physical switch routing. And so we have a number of logical networks we've defined for those. These are very small, /21/29 networks, and they're used just for this point-to-point connectivity. If we actually look at how all of these relate to each other, this is one diagram that actually shows all of them together. I'm just going to point out a few important parts of this. You can see the two DC networks are those first two blue lines. These are the data center physical switches and the subnets that get exposed down to the hosts. They are routed around and onto this VM infrastructure network. These three subnets all together make up the infrastructure logical network. At the top, you see we have the BMC and switch management networks. These are protected from the rest of the environment through ACLing and the physical switches. And so they are essentially a different security boundary, and so they have their own logical network carved out for them. You can see on the VM infra, all the infrastructure VMs are connected to that. The green bar now near the bottom is the network virtualization logical network. The main reason why it's separate from the rest of the infrastructure is because it's using a stamp private subnet. So these don't get routed off the stamp. So they actually come from a different set of addresses. So it's carved out also as its own logical network. No actual VMs connect directly to this network. All the traffic that goes over this network is encapsulated using NVGRE. And the way you actually get that encapsulation removed is either you go into a tenant VM itself, or you go through either that forwarding or multi-tenant gateway that's right down here in the bottom center. These are what do the translation from the encapsulated NVGRE that's on that network virtualization network outside to the front end, which is either your forwarding gateway front end for the forwarding gateway or the external network for the multi-tenant site-to-site NAT gateway. Services and load balancer networks, again, you can see there the hardware load balancer, which is an F5 big IP. I'll be talking about that a little more in a few minutes. It's what is essentially doing the routing from the services and load balancer networks onto the external network as well. So it's kind of acting as the boundary between those networks and the rest of the world, too. Let's talk a little bit more about that edge cluster that I mentioned and those gateway VMs that are doing that translation between the network virtualization network and, you know, those physical networks. These gateway VMs, or this edge cluster, is made up of two Hyper-V nodes out of the compute scale unit in each of the racks. And within this Hyper-V node, this Hyper-V cluster that we call the edge cluster, we have a number of guest clusters that run within here that do the actual routing. So the Hyper-V edge cluster is responsible for removing the network virtualization packets, giving them to these guest clustered VMs, and then these guest cluster VMs decide what to do with them next as they go in and out of the network. So we have five of them in each edge cluster that are set aside for site-to-site and NAT translation. This is what we call multi-tenant, because you can have up to 100 virtual networks on each one of these guest clusters. For a total of 500 virtual networks per edge cluster. We also have four set aside for doing just pure forwarding. This will forward traffic between a single virtual network and the outside world. These are the ones that I said before were for large shared networks like a DMZ, or if you need more internet-facing address space, things like that, they can go into behind these forwarding gateways. The connectivity for these gateways, when you're in multi-tenant NAT and site-to-site mode, the front end of the network, which is the bottom part, basically faces directly on the external. And that gateway gets an IP address directly on that external network. So if you create a virtual network and say you want to have NAT inbound, you will get an IP address on the external network, and it'll get assigned to that front end of that gateway. Now, on the back end, we have what's called a virtual subnet trunk that comes in that allows these multiple virtual networks to come in over a single NIC, and then the gateway itself handles maintaining the separation of that traffic into what we call compartments inside the gateway. So by doing this, this gateway can actually handle multiple virtual networks behind it, up to 100 per one of these clusters. When the gateway is configured in forwarding mode, it works a little bit differently on the front end. For inbound traffic, your physical switch has to have a static route that basically says for the subnet that's behind the gateway, because your destination is never the gateway itself. The gateway itself is just a next hop to get into the virtual network. So the physical network actually has a route that says, well, for the subnet that's behind the forwarding gateway, go to, the front-end IP address of that gateway as your next hop. In this case, it's the .4. For outbound, the gateway basically has a default route that says, anything that comes out towards me, go to the .1, which is the physical switch router. And so this basically, this forwarding gateway front-end network, it basically just acts as another point-to-point network. The only difference is you have six addresses that get used because both the physical switch with its MC lag configuration has permanent addresses and a floating address. The virtual gateway, the HNV gateway, is configured much the same way. You have an active and passive node, each one with a permanent address, and then a floating address that moves between them depending on which one is active. And so this basically just acts as for transit routing between the physical and virtual world. So let's do a quick walkthrough of what you get configured out of the box. This is all what gets set up before it gets shipped to the customer. You can see we've taken the compute scale unit and we've carved it out into individual clusters: an edge cluster, a compute cluster, and management cluster. Those are where all the workloads are running. We've pre-set up all of the logical networks so that they're all pre-assigned. In this case, this is a one rack configuration, so you see one IP pool, you see one subnet in here, but if you had a two, three, or four rack configuration, you'd see a subnet defined for each one of those racks within this logical network. So this is the type of thing you would normally have to figure out on your own. We configure this for you in advance because we know how the stamp is configured and what subnets you gave us to use to configure it. So that was the external network, and you can see all the other networks that we have in here that we've predefined in VMM. So now VMM knows how to assign IP addresses and which VLANs to use and where for each of the purposes. So we're going to work our way down through the networking section of VMM. You can see we already have the load balancer. In this case, the F5 Big IP is the one that we include in the stamp. It's already added to VMM, including its plugin. It comes out of the box. And you can see a lot of our own services that we deploy in the stamp use that F5 for their load balancing. You can see we've configured a logical switch in advance. And we've already added all the uplink port profiles that define the connectivity for each of the nodes. We've pre-configured them and got them set up so that, because VMM needs to be able to deploy all of the management workloads itself, or a lot of the other management VMs itself, it has to have this already set up in order to be able to do that. We have a number of virtual port profiles in here as well that are pre-configured for your virtual workloads, so you can set quality of service and other virtual network settings. And then all of those software gateways, those Windows Server gateways that do the translation between the virtual and physical world, those are already deployed for you into the edge cluster. They're up and running. They've been added to VMM. Again, this is something you don't have to figure out. You don't have to do it yourself. They're there, and they're running and working. You can see as we go through the properties of each of these, we've done all the connections to the host clusters, the connection to the guest clusters, and we've defined already the connectivity of each one of these VMs in advance. So they're now up and running and ready to use. We're going to work our way up to the VMs and services area in VMM. This is where we have the actual VMs. You can see within the edge cluster, each one of those gateways that we added in the networking panel is deployed as a VMM service from a VMM service template. So this service template is actually available. The service template that we use for this is basically available through WebPI for all of you to use on your own if you want to. And so we've deployed each one of these as two VM guest clusters. And they're all pre-configured and installed and ready to go. And then finally, now we're showing you basically what you see from the VMM perspective. The same thing that you saw through the Azure pack earlier, but from the VMM side, you can see the same type of virtual network with the same basic settings. In this case, this is for Humongous Insurance. It has a site-to-site tunnel, and it's also configured for NAT, so it has a can get directly routed to the internet from there. So that's just a quick walkthrough of what's pre-configured essentially in VMM when the stamp arrives. So this is all the stuff that you would normally have to do yourself, but you don't have to here. A few other things. I mentioned ACLs a little bit earlier, how we carve out different security boundaries for the BMC and the switch management networks. These are done through ACLs and the physical switches. And we have some basic rules that we use to restrict the traffic as it comes into the network. These ACLs are for restricting traffic that essentially originates within the stamp. any traffic that's destined for off the stamp, we don't restrict it, and it's up to you to actually protect your own external network from, you know, that traffic as it leaves the stamp. We also have Hyper-V virtual switch port ACLs that you can use directly on the Hyper-V host. They are a little challenging to configure, but they are available if you want to have finer grain control on a VM by VM basis on what it can talk to. All right, load balancing. You know, I've mentioned a few times we include a load balancer in the stamp because load balancing is critical importance. We include a hardware load balancer because of the throughput that we require and the reliability that we require, because we use it for our own management services. It's used by the platform as a service services, so the PaaS services, and even the tenant workloads will be using this load balancer for their configuration. It's configured entirely by us ahead of time as part of the installation. We'll do all the basic setup, defining necessary VLANs, defining all the self IPs, configuring it as a cluster. We do that for you. And then all of the virtual IPs that get created in it, those all get created through VMM, through the VMM plugin. So as you deploy all your service templates, your VM roles, VMM will go and do the load balancer configuration as part of that, those deployments. The particular device that's in there is the F5 Vyprion. We have two chassis and two modules in there, the 2100 module. And you can see on there, there are 8 ports that are available. So we actually use 2 for each rack. So you have redundancy within even a single rack configuration. And then as you scale up to, you know, 2, 3, and 4 rack configurations, you get a linear increase in your bandwidth, just like everywhere else in the network as you scale up your network. We also connect into the management port to the VMC switch as well, just for being able to connect to the management. And the serial consoles connect to the serial port concentrator. Logically, the load balancer is configured with the external as a front end. We also configure the load balancer and services networks also as front ends for the load balancer. And even the infrastructure for our own infrastructure services that use it, they can also use it and create VIPs, you know, on that load balancer. So that even our own infrastructure services can be load balanced amongst themselves. The load balancer and services network, all traffic for those goes through the load balancer. So anything that comes in goes through the load balancer, and you're restricted by whatever VIPs and ports you have defined there. And then all outbound traffic goes back through the load balancer and gets translated back into its original source destination address. All right. With that, Sudhir is going to come up here, talk about how we get a lot of data through those pipes we have there. I recommend you all get up and stretch now, take a deep breath, the seventh inning stretch before we finish up with performance and reliability.
That's great. When we started the CPS project 1 year ago, we did not want to compromise on certain things, and performance, reliability, and high availability are the key things that we really paid extra attention. So I'm going to talk about two things. I'll talk about how we have improved our networking performance and what are the design changes we made throughout the last year to get the maximum throughput. What you see on the y-axis there is the throughput in GBPS, gigabits per second. And what you see on the x-axis is various networking benchmark flows. The first one is east-west traffic. This is the traffic between two VMs within the same tenant. And you have the traffic between two VMs, north-south, but a gateway in between. The gateway could be a forwarding or a NAT or a site-to-site. So when in the initial stages, we enabled teaming, RSS and VMQ, our east-west traffic was around 4 Gbps. When we did the investigation, what we found out was that the NCAP and DCAP processing is taking a lot of time. So we went ahead and brought the Mellanox NVGRE offload NIC into the rack. That actually increased the performance by 3x. So our east-west went from 4 to 12 Gbps in this case. however, we also know that some of the processors are pegged. Hence, we wanted to move to the latest and greatest processor. So we moved from Sandy Bridge to Ivy Bridge. The max throughput that we got on this particular rack is east-west is 18 Gbps, which is close to the line rate. That's what we have shipped CPS with. Some of the gateways, such as NAT, we get around 10, forwarding we get around 8. Site-to-site is approximately 2 Gbps. Questions? We don't talk, I mean, this particular slide is purely networking. Tanmay did that?
Yeah, there was a session yesterday on the architecture of CPS, and in that session we talked about the IOPS that we can get out of the storage.
Sure. There are also certain VM settings that we have done as part of the previous exercise. One of our recommendations is to enable VRSS in the guest. VRS is a software feature that we delivered. This is where the networking interrupt processing is actually spread across multiple processors. As you can see in this case, we kick in VRSS at certain threshold. When a processor is pegged beyond a certain threshold, we actually kick in the VRSS. As you can see, when VRSS kicks in, we almost reach the line rate. If your hardware supports VMQ, we also recommend to enable VMQ, and that's how you actually enable that in VMM. So whether you use CPS or not, these are the settings that you can use both on host and VM site to achieve the maximum networking throughput. That is one takeaway that I wanted to mention. There could also be some performance issues on VMs if your VMQ processor is not scheduled on the same NUMA node. I just wanted to mention that this is not a big issue, as the aggregation of the VM throughput will be around 13 to 15 Gbps anyways. But if you see on a particular VM that the performance has gone down, make sure you affinitize the VMQ to the same NUMA node. There are PowerShell commands for that. So this is a demo of how much throughput we are achieving with on the east-west. We are going to first achieve 13 gigabits and then 18. I hope we achieve 13. I'm sure we'll achieve 13 because it's not a live demo. So what we are seeing here, oops. Okay, started. Is it really live?
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. So we have two VMs. Each VM has two VM NICs. What we are going to do is, so as you can see that there is no throughput. We are not sending any traffic. All the processes are idle. There are 32 processors on this host machine. All of them are idle. So this is the first VM. We have two subnets, 168.2 and 168.1. And it's the same on the second VM as well. We're going to type the same command and see that. What we are going to do is, we will make one VM as a listening server and one VM as a traffic sender. So we are going to use a tool called CTS traffic tool. This is something that we have internally developed. This is also publicly available for your usage. So we have enabled that as a listening server, and we are going to send traffic on that particular subnet and on that port. And we are going to open up at least 100 connections to achieve the throughput. As you can see, the th- throughput is around 4, and on the receiving side is also around 4. Quickly, the VRSS will kick in and we'll go around 10 to 13 Gbps. As you can see, now the processing is actually spread across all the processors. And we have achieved around 11, 12, and 13 is where we cap. So what we wanted to do is enable or send the traffic on the second interface as well to achieve around 18. So we're going to start again, you know, make this particular port listen to the traffic, and we will again send the same CTS traffic with 100 connections and see how much we are going to achieve. As the traffic is slowly kicking in, we go around 9 and 9. That is that's the point at which we peak. So you can see that all the processes are equally pegged. This is with VRSS, VMQ, and all the perf tuning that I talked about. So you can see 9 and 9 approximately. That is the maximum east-west traffic or throughput that we can achieve. So the next topic that I'm going to talk about is reliability. One of the key aspects in our design is to make sure our gateways are always highly available, and they run in active and passive mode. Greg talked about some of the redundancy that we put in place for our switches. Except the BMC switch, we can actually sustain failure of any one device, and we will make sure that the VM workload continues to run. The same is true for the edge cluster, load balancer, and all our switches. So this is a demonstration of what happens when switch goes down. In any of the switch goes down in the tenant, a DC switch, and aggregated switch. We have also to simulate all these failures and to make sure the CPS rack is highly reliable. We also developed a tool called Private Cloud Simulator. What it does is it deploys a private cloud on demand at any point of time and actually achieve that particular scale. And that actually performs a lot of data center operations such as deployment, live migrations, node failures, and any of the edge node failures as well. So as you can see, some of the numbers that I wanted to talk about is we have performed for every iteration around 200 planned edge node failures. Likewise, storage failures were simulated through that, and the compute failures were simulated using this tool. So we have done extensive testing and analysis of node failures to make sure our workloads are always up and running. So this is a demo of VM to external traffic using a NAT gateway. While that's happening, I'm going to plan failover the gateway role and we'll make sure that the workload will continue to run. So what we have is similar setup, two VMs with that particular IP, and it will actually talk to the external network. You can see that external IP. This is going through the NAT gateway. And we're using the same CTS traffic to generate this traffic. What you see is the throughput going up. And then when you look at the cluster manager, we have a host cluster, which has two nodes. These are host clustered for high availability. That is 34-1 and 36-1. We also have 9 gateways deployed. Those are all the 9 PA addresses corresponding to those gateways. We also have a NAT cluster that has 2 VMs, which are also guest clustered for the high availability. And we also have a NAT role, and it is running on that 101 VM. So you can see that the throughput has gone up to approximately 4. What we are going to do is failover that particular gateway role. So we're back to the cluster manager. This particular PA is running on the 34-1 host, and we are going to move that to a best possible node. As you can see now that the networking throughput will drop down for a couple of seconds, and the gateway role will move to pending, and it will quickly come to the running state. As you can see, the throughput actually again start coming up. And now the PA actually moved from 34-1 to 36-1. And as you can see, you know, there won't be any downtime in the VM workload, as we can quickly reliably fail over to the other node. That's the end of the demo. To recap, we have talked about our CPS design and what are the things that we actually considered in the design of CPS, and in particular the networking configurations. And we talked about the performance and reliability of the networking. As I was mentioning in my previous talk, we had 4 sessions done by our team specifically around CPS and what is coming up in SDN on the vNext release. We also have the Ask the Experts right after this, where a lot of colleagues from my team will participate. And here is an extra content that you can always refer. And please submit your feedback. With that, Greg and I will take any questions.